This podcast may contain explicit language.
Welcome to the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast, the show that uses a unique grading style to redefine what the greatest movies are. I'm Tom Duncan.
And I'm Dana Duncan.
Tonight, for our 204th episode, we discuss the harrowing drama, The Diary of Anne Frank, celebrating its 65th anniversary this week. Directed by George Stevens, written by Frances Goodrich and Albert Hackett, music by Alfred Newman, starring Millie Perkins as Anne Frank, Joseph Schildkraut as Otto Frank, Shelley Winters as Petronella von Dahn, Richard Boehmer as Peter von Dahn, Gusti Huber as Edith Frank, Lou Jacoby as Hans von Dahn, Diane Baker as Margot Frank, Douglas Spencer as Mr. Crayler, Dodie Heath as Meep, and Ed Wynn as Albert Dussel. Recognition for this movie? The Diary of Anne Frank was originally released on March 18, 1959. The film was mostly positively received by critics at the time, and would be nominated for 7 Academy Awards, winning for Best Supporting Actress for Shelley Winters, Art Direction in Black and White, and Cinematography in Black and White. Despite its critical success, the film would not even make back its own budget, grossing only an estimated $2.3 million on a budget of $3.8 million. In 2006, it was honored as the 18th most inspiring American film on the list of AFI's 100 Years, 100 Cheers. The Diary of Anne Frank currently holds an 81% rating among critics on Rotten Tomatoes, a 59 score on Metacritic, and a 3.7 out of 5 on Letterboxd. So, Dad, as we start each week, what is your relationship to this movie?
None.
Never seen it?
Never seen it. In fact, I'd forgotten that there was even a movie until it was on our list.
I remember specifically, and I want to say that we had started reading the Corrie ten Boom book in like third grade, and we would have like these breaks every day in grade school where for 15, 20 minutes, maybe a half an hour max, we would put on some type of movie or a video of some kind. But I remember that, shout out to my third and fourth grade teacher, Connie Burrow. If she's even still around, I don't know.
She's not. She passed.
Oh, she did. Okay. See, that,
has
there
cancer.
You go. Well, I knew she had been ill for quite some time, but I didn't hear what it ended up. So, you know, but shout out to her from beyond the grave at this point, who showed us this movie. And I think over the course of like 2 weeks or something, because obviously it's a long movie, I remember watching this in like third grade or whatever else. And between the book, not necessarily the Diary of Anne Frank, but the Corrie ten Boom book, which the name escapes me at this point, and this movie, I kind of got my first sense of what the Holocaust was, or at least, you know, a roundabout idea. It wasn't until I started to get into like fifth and sixth grade and you started to see some of the pictures, and I got into like really reading history books for whatever reason, you know, not genetics or anything. But that I got like the further seriousness of it. But this gave you kind of the first inklings of kind of what happened in this circumstance. A little of an appreciation beyond we beat the Germans.
Yes.
And I suppose I should be more specific. We beat the Nazis as opposed to the German people. So what is the movie about?
It is about survival. It is about finding what hope, beauty, solace you can take in turmoil and fear. It's just it's a story of attempts to survive and the sacrifice sometimes that it takes in order to do that.
I don't want to make it seem like this is a like for like, but rewatching this movie after going through COVID and the lockdowns, it hits you in a much different way. You're afraid to go outside for a year, year and a half, basically. If you do go outside, it's with lots of protection. You're wiping down everything. And while the threat of certain demise is not quite as apparent with us at that time as it was with them, and now looking back on it, we were kind of silly about a lot of things, like masking outside, but we just didn't know the difference at the time. But being cooped up with certain people for an extended period of time caused rifts that either never healed or took a long time to heal. I mean, the divorce rate was considerably up, although so was the marriage rate. So how people adapted in closed quarters for a couple of years, essentially, I could understand why this movie is a lot about extreme circumstances, optimism in the face of a overwhelming adversity, and kind of a paranoia of evil, and finding somehow optimism in the face of all that. But it's also from the perspective of what is essentially a child. So it's her developing adolescence, because I think she does develop a lot over the course of the 3 hours of this movie. There's kind of a rebellious sort early on in the film, and then she seemingly becomes kind of a mini surrogate of her father's composure by the end of the film, even to the point where he feels that she was better than he was. And I think that gives that emotional gut punch at the end.
No, I get all of that, and it is a coming-of-age story as part of this, which is you get to see her maturation through the course of this. The adversity matures her at a faster rate than she probably would have had she not been through this torture. And that's what I'm going to call it, torture, which is periods of complete boredom surrounded by periods of sheer terror.
It makes you wonder if people are better off for being challenged earlier in life. Like, I don't want to make it so that it's one side or the other is better per se, because we've definitely seen a lot of people that come out worse for having a lot of adversity early on. But we also see a lot of people that are disadvantaged or potentially stunted, I think in a way I might be, because they had a relatively easy early life.
Nobody wants a horrible life, but I found it interesting. Robert Downey's acceptance speech at the Academy. I want to thank first my horrible childhood and second the Academy, in that order. I mean, his father got him hooked on drugs at age 8.
Now, there's some undue influence for you.
Yeah.
So this is famously an adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play and Tony-winning play, which is adapted from the book. Which of those three things is the catalyst for the legacy that Anne Frank currently has?
Well, I did some checking. Otto had a hard time finding publishers. He first had a publisher publish it in the Netherlands. Then it got picked up and was published in Britain and France and Germany. He had a very difficult time getting it published in the United States. He was turned down by 10 publishers. Finally, Doubleday acquired the rights and released it in the United States in 1952 with only 5,000 copies made available. It got reviewed by Meyer Levine in the New York Times Book Review. At that point in time, the first run sold out immediately. The second run was 15,000 copies, and that sold out within days, which was followed by a third run of 45,000 copies, which sold out in a few days. And it continued to go through that process until approximately 1 million copies had been sold by the end of the decade.
I wanted to say it's like one of the top 10 selling books of the 20th century.
And Martin Levine actually wanted to be involved in the movie rights, and he tried to put it together his own script. Otto did not like the script. He then contracted with other people to write the movie, one of which had done the stage play. And then ultimately, Levine and Otto Franke ended up in litigation over copyright infringement that Levine was saying he took certain parts of his idea and incorporated them into the movie anyway without his consent or whatever. I don't know the result of it, but I know that there was some significant litigation over it. So in answer to your question, I would say the book drove the story. In the 4 years I was in high school, I believe one group of the freshman class and one group of the senior class read the book in my high school for English class. I never read the book because of the track I was in. It just wasn't on my reading list. I got to read other really entertaining books like Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Well, this book technically outsold it, not by a lot, but several million copies, I think, all time. It has outsold The Great Gatsby, Gone with the Wind, Rebecca, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Lost Symbol, The Hunger Games, James and the Giant Peach, just to name a few. The only books that have sold higher than it, well, I mean, there's quite a few, but the notable ones, let's say, Angels and Demons, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, Charlotte's Web, Black Beauty, Lolita, The Bridges of Madison County, The Catcher in the Rye, The Alchemist, all the Harry Potter books, The Da Vinci Code. A Tale of Two Cities is the number one most sold book. The Hobbit is also over 100 million, and the original Harry Potter book is the only one over 100 million copies sold. Number two is The Little Prince.
Ah, okay.
And I'm not even familiar with the Agatha Christie book that's her apparent top seller one. And then there were none.
That is the fourth or fifth Poirot novel. I believe it's the one that's right before or two before Murder on the Orient Express.
Well, I definitely can't say what the original printed name was of this one. And it's none of her major characters. It's not Poirot. It's not Miss Marple. But it's her best-selling book.
And then there were none?
Yep.
Boy, I thought I had a copy of it and or haven't read it yet, but okay.
You might, but I'm telling you, it has none of her major characters in it at all.
Hmm. Maybe it's one I have on audio that your mother and I were listening to while we were driving someplace.
I'll just say this. It was originally published as 10 Little Racial Epitaph or Slur. I will let you fill in the blank there.
It was 10 Little Indians. I don't believe that is a racial slur if you're referring to them in that way.
No.
Oh.
That was its second name.
Oh, okay. So this would also have been the same name as a certain football team from Washington?
No.
Oh.
It is a common slur used for African Americans.
I see.
That only they are allowed to use at this point in time, and that they often call each other for some reason.
What the hell? I mean, why would you? Okay.
1939 was a different time, I guess.
I guess. I mean,
we hadn't even integrated the military yet.
No, that didn't happen until 47.
So given that none of the movie actually happens inside a concentration camp, there are very few instances of soldiers. Is this a Holocaust movie?
Yes, because the fear of capture and being sent for extermination is palpable throughout the entire film. I think this is more of a Holocaust story than some of the Holocaust stories I've seen, because once they're in the camp, you have a good idea of what's going to happen. It's the aversion of trying to avoid it and the fear that arises that really creates the suspense of, you know, I mean, how could you day in and day out for 2 years really live like that and be able to not go insane?
See, I don't come down on one side or the other of this discussion. I raise it for the simple fact of I want people to think about where they come down on it, because we just got done with what I would say is one of the more loosely based or loosely defined, I guess, is the better terminology, Holocaust films in the zone of interest.
Yes.
Where the majority of it in the actual plotting and the storyline really doesn't have to do explicitly with it, and yet it does. And so I'm trying to wrap my head a little bit around where all of this falls. Is everything that takes place around this point a Holocaust movie? Are only some things Holocaust movies or stories? I think most people would easily say that this does fall into that, but I don't know where everyone would necessarily draw that distinction.
Well, this thing with Zone of Interest is that it took it to the nth degree. You know, the number of people that were alive in Germany at that time who said, I didn't know what was going on in those camps. And, you know, how the order from the Allies, I can't remember if it was Patton or Eisenhower, gave the order of having the civilian population around the concentration camps march through and see what was going on, and then conscript people from the villages surrounding it to bury the bodies so that they understood the horror. That was what Zone of Interest was primarily about, was people living their lives during that time period. They were a little more emphasized because they lived right in the middle of the camp where the wall that surrounded or was next to the camp. And as they're doing their normal activities, they can hear the shouts and the cries and the gunfire and all the stuff associated with the camp. It emphasized how these people were living their lives and being and trying to ignore what was actually going on. This is just the opposite, which is people trying to live their lives to survive for a period of time and doing what they could to have some semblance of existence while they tried to wait out the potential horror that would await.
So do you have our plot summary ready for us?
I do. The Diary of Anne Frank is a poignant film adaptation of the stage play based on the iconic diary written by Anne Frank, a Jewish girl who, along with her family and a few others, hid from the Nazis in an attic in Amsterdam during World War II. The film portrays the daily struggles, fears, and hopes of the occupants as they try to evade discovery by the Nazis while enduring the harsh realities of confinement. Through Anne's eyes, viewers witness her coming of age amidst the turmoil of war, grappling with typical teenage issues while also confronting the atrocities of the Holocaust. The film, directed by George Stevens, captures the resilience of the human spirit in the face of unimaginable adversity, ultimately leaving a profound and lasting impact on audiences as they bear witness to one of the darkest chapters in history.
Thank you. Did you know? Audrey Hepburn was first offered the role of Anne Frank, and Otto Frank was among those who nominated her. She refused it for three reasons. Firstly, she had decided to accept the role in Green Mansions. Secondly, she had lived in the occupied Netherlands during the war and had seen the Nazis carry out street executions and watched as they herded Jews onto boxcars to carry them to concentration camps. She knew that making the film would bring back memories that were far too painful for her. However, thirdly, she was 30 and felt that she was too old to play a teenage character convincingly on screen. Did you know? Shelley Winters donated the Best Supporting Actress Academy Award she won for the role of Mrs. Van Daan to the Anne Frank Museum in Amsterdam in 1975 after promising Otto Frank that she would do so if she were to win the award. It remains on permanent display in the museum to this day. Did you know? Anne Frank created aliases for her roommates in the diary, feeling that some of her revelations would prove embarrassing and harmful to them should they survive the war. The Van Daan family was really named Van Pels, and the surname of Mr. Dussel, the dentist, was really Pfeffer. Did you know? 20th Century Fox was filming most of its movies in the extra-large dimensions of CinemaScope in order to lure patrons out of their homes and away from their small televisions. However, George Stevens felt that the wide spectrum of CinemaScope took away from the claustrophobic feel that being confined in an attic for 2 years would produce. Therefore, in order to achieve the effect that he desired without defying the order to film in CinemaScope, the director added columns on each side of the set, supposedly to be the beams, but were actually to narrow the width of the screen, thus producing the stifling feel he originally intended. Did you know? Millie Perkins, cast as the younger Anne, was older than both Diane Baker, who plays Margot, her older sister, and Richard Boehmer, who plays Peter during the making of the movie. And with that, we will take our first break and we will be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, next week for our 205th episode, we discuss the unforeseen smash hit from 2004, The Passion of the Christ, celebrating its 20th anniversary. Written and directed by Mel Gibson with Benedict Fitzgerald, music by John Debney, starring Jim Caviezel and Monica Bellucci. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where it's streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. Dad, we left off at best performance. Who do you have down?
I have Joseph Schildkraut. I thought he portrayed just a really loving, compassionate, but stern leadership. And I think he kept them together and safe as long as possible, primarily at his, you know, at Otto's abilities. I think he portrayed that throughout. You could tell his level of fear and see it, but he also was able to portray it as being a level of, I need to be strong for everybody else type of thing. So I thought his performance was phenomenal. And to be perfectly honest, I don't understand why he wasn't nominated for anything. I liked his performance better than Ed Wynn.
Based on the way that the characters are drawn, and some of it from the pointed point of view of the diary, Ed Wynn's character is supposed to be the one you hate the most. He's the most irritating. I think by that standard, then, he actually does do a pretty good job, because all of his little ticks and comments and side swipes at everybody really aid to us feeling like he is the antagonist of the film, when obviously the antagonist is the Nazis outside. But you have this kind of inner turmoil being churned through all of that. And then obviously Mr. Von Dahn and some of the antics that go on with that. But I have Schildkraut as my best secondary performance for a lot of the same reasons. The way that that character is portrayed has two things going for it. One, openly, during the course of the movie, and I would assume the diary, even though I've never read it, she clearly loves her father, probably the most of anybody in the world. So she has this mythology, in a way, built up around the character of who he is. And then he's the only one that was able to advise both the play and the movie as to what took place. Now, I think some of it is borrowed from being able to see him somewhat in action in real life. And yet, I wonder if that was always his level of composure, if he was capable of handling that much pressure and inertia and paranoia with that much level of calm. But his performance stands out because the character stands out.
Okay.
That's not to say that he did a poor job in any sense. I nominate him for best supporting performance or best secondary performance. He's probably the second most important character in the movie. And if that role doesn't work, if you somehow overplay it, if you lose your head at all, it doesn't seem convincing that this guy would be seemingly holding everybody together. So it's a level of resolute calmness and composure to not lose his head while everyone around him is losing theirs, that I think provides the backbone for the film and allows you to think, boy, without this guy, they probably wouldn't have even lasted a week or two.
So was he unsettlingly calm?
No, I found him settlingly calm.
So there's only one person who's unsettlingly calm that you know?
That I know personally, yes.
Okay.
And it's only in certain circumstances, so, you know.
Yeah, I assume that the about half the audience is wondering who we're talking about, and the other half of the audience is reading between the lines.
All I'll say is that if you don't know what we're talking about, this has come up probably in at least a dozen episodes over the course of the show. So you have some work to do to listen to some back episodes.
I'm sorry, but the more tense and more troubling events go around me, the calmer I get, because I just get into a zone of having to think clearly and rationally.
You do it less often than you used to be able to. I think age is worn on your ability to remain composed in a lot of stressful situations.
I haven't had to be in that many stressful situations lately, but okay.
I don't know. I think if we look back over it, you've had quite a bit in the last couple of years. Maybe not in an intense or urgent manner in the way that it was when my great uncle passed out in the lobby of the office. But, you know, how many times does that happen?
It was in the dining room at the house.
Oh, excuse me. I thought it was at the office, but okay.
Nope.
Either way.
Yeah.
Moving on. My best performance was George Stevens, because of the aura and the respect that he created with the movie. Like, I don't think that he made it too intense to not be potentially enjoyable. I think he kept the subject material alive without creating it to be haunting or impossible to be entertaining, but that you can't also learn from it. And yes, to a degree, he's adapting the stage play, but he's doing it in a different capacity. We often see a lot of stage plays that will take place in kind of a two-dimensional viewpoint. They'll take the stage setting and basically just open up the fourth wall like you would on an actual stage, and then that just becomes how you film it. And this was not one of those. He made the space livable, breathable, that you knew by the end of the movie kind of every inch of what was going on in there. And it never really felt too foreign. Like, you kind of understood everything that was going on in each individual room. You knew where certain people's rooms were. You knew where the bathroom was. You kind of understood the space and the space they were in at all points. But then it aids with the second half of the film, where they start to really turn on each other. Some people get closer. Some people start to fracture. And I think the use of space and how he sets that up also aids well to it. The use of the cat as the MacGuffin, more or less, I think that has maybe more to do with the writing, but there's still a visual style that he imparts on that to tell something where that cat, I wanted to kill it. It doesn't help that I'm not a particular fan of cats to begin with, but even so. And then finally, he creates what I would say are some Hitchcockian level paranoia scenes in the two burglary scenes that I was tense. I was on the edge of my seat. They were just fantastic in creating the sense of urgency and dread that you'd want from just about any thriller that you could have. I'm sorry, it was limited to those two spots, but if you were doing that for about 3 hours, that would be a very, very long movie.
Yeah.
So he's my best performer.
Okay.
Who is your best secondary?
I had Shelley Winters. I went in this because I didn't see a lot of things with Shelley Winters in them. I mean, she was very popular in the late 50s, early 60s. She historically was Marilyn Monroe's roommate when they were both in the Actors Studio studying under Lee Strasberg and Stella, I believe. Stella Strasberg, I think, was his wife. So I knew of her, but most of the time I saw Shelley Winters, she had gained weight. She was kind of this flighty, kind of over-the-top guest on The Tonight Show. And so I never saw her in anything that I thought was really required much attention or much acting skill. I mean, the first time I think I saw her in a film was The Poseidon Adventure, where she was married in that film to Jack Albertson. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, watching her performance in there and the subtleties of how she would have levels of paranoia, guilt, rage. I don't know how you would describe it, but trying to hold on to some semblance of what her life was before. I think that mink coat represented not just the value of the mink coat, but it was the last thing she had to identify herself with, the way her life was before occupation. So I thought her performance was really nuanced. And having watched it, and I watched her very closely, I can see why she won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for it.
Not to rain on your parade, but given the notoriety that going into this, you know that she got an award for acting. I also paid very close attention to it, but I went in the opposite direction. I thought it was grossly overacted. I thought she was shrill, grating at times, and I couldn't really find much sympathy with that character at all.
I don't think there was supposed to be a lot.
I guess I just don't see what I'm supposed to get, why that's a brilliant performance.
I think the range of emotions and how she had to portray them at various moments in time was really what marked the performance.
Most charismatic for me, I have Millie Perkins as Anne.
I agree.
I don't think the movie works unless you can connect with her on multiple levels. From a innocence of adolescence, a hopeful optimism, a kid growing up in unusual circumstances, but that still has a longing for being loved, being liked, trying to get through things without losing a sense of self, and without sympathizing with her certain rebellious nature early on in the film and not finding that childish. I think that she ultimately does a great job in making us care about her and, in a way, loving her, which is the whole point of the movie.
I agree. At times I thought her acting was a little stumbling.
Her line deliveries weren't great.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
But she portrayed a level of innocence that you'd find in an adolescent girl. You could tell by her acting performance, the level of maturity that had taken place throughout the film between the beginning and the end. I thought overall she did a great job. I did some checking on it because I was curious because I'd never seen her in much else. But apparently George Stevens had commented that she was at the very tail end of the studio system and she bucked and refused to do some of the films they wanted to put her in. So they fired her, and then they had a free-for-all, and she basically didn't work, probably until the mid to late 70s again. She did a few things here and there, more independent stuff, not a lot. And so from what I'm gathering from George Stevens' comments, during that period, she did not portray well with the studios because she was kind of the counterculture, kind of sided with the anti-establishment movement that was going on in Hollywood that ultimately broke through in the late 60s. And as a result, she kind of didn't have a lot of opportunities because of the background or with whom she was spending her time.
Let's move to best scene then. I have the opening, returning to the attic. Then I have the first burglary. I have the bombing campaign, so the night when everything kind of is blowing up around them and the shells are falling and the windows blow out, etc. Then I have probably the longest single scene of the movie, which is the night of Hanukkah. So we go from the presents to the second burglary and the mishap that happens during that, with then the cops investigating and they thinking they're going to get caught, and then finishing with the end of the Hanukkah celebration. Then I have in Peter's room, which is their conversation after they've kind of realized an affection for one another. And then I have the conclusion, which we flash forward in time back to the opening, which bookends the story for me. Now, out of these, did I miss anything that you would like to include?
Do you deem the food theft and the invasion seen as a separate or inclusive of something else you've given?
I don't have either of those, no.
Well, I combine them. I think that is a scene that I would want to include because actually it's my favorite scene. It goes from complete hatred because of the circumstances and what had taken place to the opposite end, which is exhilaration, thinking that there's an end in sight. I think you had in that scene both ends, humanity at its worst without hope, and at the same time, humanity at its point of exhilaration that hope is there. To me, that was my favorite scene because of just the wide range of emotions that had to be conveyed in that very short period of time.
So then what do you have as your best scene?
I have the second Hanukkah and the second burglary.
I do as well. Not only for its length, but just the variety of different things that are taking place in that. There's a kindliness to her giving the presents individually to all of the people around the table without their expectation of things being gifted to them that in some ways kind of reminds me of a lot of Christmas movies. But then to go from that to the sheer terror of the second burglar and then the crashing over the cat with then the investigation. So they come out of the hole and you have the, I guess, soldiers coming in and trying to investigate, all down to, are they going to catch us because the cat's meowing? That's just a intricately directed scene. And when I say it's like Hitchcockian level, that's what I'm talking about, is that moment in time where you have the tension and all of that buildup with, are they going to get caught? Even though I think it concludes before intermission, technically, in the movie. I just think from a technical standpoint, from the sheer difference in all of the actors and the surrounding things and the emotions and then them getting upset and resolving things by the end of that sequence, it just has the most going on in any one individual scene.
I agree. I mean, it is an excellent scene. I mean, just the sheer terror. You can feel the entire time your own pulse as you're waiting and watching them go through that.
It very much feels like a quiet place and you can't make any sounds or you'll potentially be caught.
When I have not seen the film in full, but when I saw the previews, it almost reminded me of that that's what it is. I think that somewhat is a strong parallel. I'd love to ask Krasinski if that was his idea.
My favorite scene I have in Peter's room, to me, one of the few things that I really bought into as far as the characters and their development over the course of the film is this budding relationship between Peter and Anne and how they seem to grow an affection for one another. I mean, call me an old soft romantic, but there's a certain innocence, sweetness to that scene of them trying to discuss where they're at in their lives, what they could be, and where they would like to go if they were to survive everything that I really bought into. Most indelible moment for you?
The conclusion.
I also had the same.
Yeah, it's the most gut-wrenching. When you listen to it, how close they were to escaping. You know, and quite frankly, when the invasion went through, and especially as the Allies were able to liberate Paris, Hitler directed Himmler to triple and quadruple the amount of exterminations, because Hitler was determined that even if he failed and went down in flames, he was going to take every Jew he could out with him. And that's kind of the comment that was being made, or what was discussed in a lot of the books and such on the Third Reich at that time was the level of determination by the upper levels of the Nazi regime.
I also have the conclusion, but more because of the one popular line, which we'll get to in quotes, but I still believe people are good at heart. I mean, if that doesn't hit you right in the feels, I don't know what will. So that's a good spot for our second break. We'll be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, and before we get to the Stanley rubric in a minute, if you're ever curious about our Master Greatest Movies of All Time list that has every graded movie we've ever discussed on the show, there's a link in the episode description of every episode of this show, or you can go to ronnieduncanstudios.com/gmotepodcast and find it as the top entry on the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast show page. That is the grades we've done so far for all 189 movies we've graded, and we continue to add more each week. Make sure to check that out as we go and follow along. Also, you can follow each individual episode on our website as well. That is the notes for each individual episode with all of our scores, category nominations, and the individual factoids for each episode of the show. Just click the link in the episode description of this episode or go to ronnieduncanstudios.com/gmotepodcast to find that. Dad, do we have anyone to remember this week?
Yes, we do. Ahmed El Shinawi, 75, Egyptian actor. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Midnight Express, and The Element of Crime.
In reading his obituary today, his role in Temple of Doom was one of the participants of the dinner that Kate Capshaw freaks out over. In fact, I think he had to eat the snake.
Ah. Malachi McCourt, 92, American actor. Ryan's Hope, Search for Tomorrow, and was in the film Gods and Generals. He was also an author and politician.
And I don't believe he was actually American because he originally emigrated from Ireland. I hope I have that right. I can never remember emigrate or immigrate. But anyway, his brother is Francis McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes.
Oh.
About their youth.
Okay. I love Gods and Generals, by the way.
It's a total Dana movie. Of course.
Yes, it is. Yep. Eric Carmen, 74, American musician with the Raspberries and songwriter, All by Myself and Hungry Eyes. Two very good songs from the 80s, late 70s, 80s. Jerry Foley, 68, American television director, directed Late Night with David Letterman.
For over 30 years.
T.M. Stevens, 72, American bass guitarist with the Pretenders. He also worked with Steve Vai, James Brown, and Bootsy Collins. Linda Belgord, 84, American stage actress and singer. She was in The Pirate Queen, Cats, and The Phantom of the Opera. I would assume all on Broadway.
Correct.
Steve Lawrence, 88, American singer, Go Away Little Girl, Footsteps, an actor, The Blues Brothers. He was a Grammy and Emmy winner. He had a long career. He was teamed up for the most part with Edie Gourmet, his wife of, oh, I believe, 50-some years till her passing, and also did a lot of panel shows in the 50s and early 60s. Michael Culver, 85, English actor. The Empire Strikes Back, From Russia with Love, and Thunderball.
He had very small, like, cameo parts, essentially, in From Russia with Love and Thunderball. But his biggest claim to fame is that he was Captain Nita in The Empire Strikes Back, who classically dies at the hands of Darth Vader.
Vasella Richard, 79. British actress, Black Snake and Zeta One. Jean Allison, 94, American actress. Edge of Fury, Bad Company, Hardcore, and various TV credits. And James Beard, 63, American musician, keyboardist for Steely Dan. I believe, if I remember right, he joined Steely Dan in the late 80s, after their big run in the 70s. He was more of a newer member of the band, but died very suddenly when they were about to go on tour.
I thought they had just finished tour with the Eagles.
Well, maybe I heard it back or misunderstood or am mistaken, but it was very sudden, let's put it that way.
And so we commemorate these here for their contributions to the arts with a moment of silence here in their honor. Thank you. And might I add that we're recording this technically only a few days after the Oscars, even though it's going to come out about 10 days later. But our In Memoriam is a lot better than theirs was.
Yes, I pride myself on our In Memoriam and try to do it with some level of class and dignity instead of it being almost, it gets a bit worse every year.
Well, they left off several names again, including Lance Reddick and Norman Lear, although that was more TV.
But, although he would produce several films.
So you had technically called that Norman Lear might not be included at all. Maybe not on the program, but you had said because he was more involved in TV, it might not be predictive. And instead we got some weird interpretive dance thing that became the focus of it instead of the individual names or their contributions or trying to recognize them in any sort of way for what they did to the industry for years. So I'm sorry, Oscars. I enjoyed this telecast, but that was the one thing that you really got wrong. Forgive me if I don't put my hat in the ring to help produce the show, at least for that one segment.
I think we should start a campaign that you and I do the In Memoriam in the next Oscar show. We'll do it for free. Just, you know, let us in the door. We'll take care of it and give us the info stuff. I'll do it for free.
The only things that I would require, not necessarily that I do it for free. I would do it without salary, but I would like to attend the ceremony.
Yes.
And I would like to get some type of private tour of the Academy Museum. Those would be my two requests.
I think I would like an opportunity.
I'll fly myself out.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll be glad to do that too. In fact, I'll, if I get an opportunity to get to meet backstage the presenters for next year, because I think it would be really cool to meet Cillian Murphy and Robert Downey Jr. And they're likely to be presenters because they won this year.
Well, yes, that is the tradition.
I know.
You don't want to meet Nick Cage.
Oh, hell, if I could meet Nick Cage, I'd meet Nick Cage. I think it'd be cool.
You know, there's a treasure map on FDR's wheelchair.
Okay.
All right. So let's move to best funniest lines.
Not appropriate in this context.
Well, let's just say it's best lines, not funniest lines this time.
Yeah.
My first one up. I know it's terrible trying to have any faith when people are doing such horrible, but you know what I sometimes think? I think the world may be going through a phase, the way I was with Mother. It'll pass. Maybe not hundreds of years, but someday. I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are really good at heart.
And you know, the most wonderful part of thinking outside yourself, you can have it any way you like. You can have rows of roses and violets all blooming in the same season. Isn't that wonderful?
Otto, we don't need the Nazis to destroy us. We're destroying ourselves.
Otto, for the past 2 years, we have lived in fear. Now we can live in hope.
Otto, always remember this, Anna. There are no walls, no bolts, no locks that anyone can put on your mind.
Well, that was the last one I had.
Okay, I've got a few more. Anne, I want to go on living even after I'm dead. Anne, we're not the only people that have to... We're not the only people that have had to suffer. There have always been people that have had to. Interesting perspective. And finally, Anne, I've never heard grown-ups quarrel before. Mr. Hans von Damme, it's not a quarrel, it's a discussion. That felt very much like, I didn't hit her, I pushed her with my hand aggressively. Ah, the children of an attorney.
Yes.
How much they take after their father. Everything's got to be a semantics debate.
Yes.
All right, you ready to move to the Stanley Rubric?
I am.
All right, Legacy is up first. Do you want to go first or second?
I'll go first.
Okay.
I mean, it's still widely discussed as being a classic movie, and it's made several lists. But I don't think it's really held in pantheon of great films the way some are. So I'm going to give it its due because I think it did further propel George Stevens' career as a director through the 60s. So I went with a 3 for the industry. Now, we did our little informal poll in the office, and I was surprised by the number of people, and then those even who were under 30 who had seen this film. In fact, I was shocked. But my guess is it's because the book is taught in school and in high schools and such, and then they do the film after the end of the time when they watch the book or read the book, which is probably why. But still, the fact that people had seen the film and it's well known yet, I'm going to give it a 2 for the public, because at least a portion of the public is familiar with it. I think there is also a large portion of the public who has no idea there's a film. So I have a 5 overall.
So on an industry standpoint, I would agree with your number. Maybe not every point that you made, but I think we come at it somewhat similarly, or at least in the same ballpark. I just don't see there being a lot of industry celebration of the film. It was recognized in its moment, but it's mostly been forgotten kind of afterward, comparative to a lot of films that came after it about similar subject material. I don't think it, in its moment, corresponded to the attitude that we had towards World War II, particularly in America, where we were kind of beating our chests a bit and saying that we had rid the world of a great evil, but then didn't appreciate the levels to which that evil was inflicted. And I don't think that we really came to appreciate it until much later, post-Vietnam, when we kind of took a much longer examination of war and its effects on the citizenry in order to truly understand what was going on in that time period, or appreciate. Maybe we knew about it, but we didn't necessarily appreciate it in the way that it probably is appreciated now. So I have a 3 as well for the industry side of it.
Just a second. This is 12 years after Gentleman's Agreement. So there was still a lot of anti-Semitism running in this country in the 40s into the 50s.
We're actively running anti-Semitism ads during the Oscars.
I know, because it's rearing its very ugly head again.
Well, I'm saying that it's never completely gone away.
No.
But that film being released is not necessary, and winning Best Picture is not necessarily indicative of a widespread nature that we'd like to think it is, even though up until that point in time, America had been a fairly main participant in anti-Semitic behavior institutionally in a way we would kind of like to forget. But even so, on a audience level, I think the name ID is high. I think most people think this is the actual name of the book, even though it's not.
Yes.
Because they know the book, they think they kind of know the movie, and that there's a lot of overlap, even though I would say it's one's adapted from the other, but this puts more of a narrative on it in a way that the diary, I would assume, does not quite. It's much more day-by-day type of writing. So with that, I still think that the narrative function of the movie serves to live a little bit longer in people's minds. I take your point that there is a certain group of people that probably don't know the movie exists, but I wonder how big in proportion to the amount of kids that have been exposed to the book, the play, the movie, don't at least recognize a lot of the beats of the story. And so maybe I grade it a little bit more softly than you. I'll take it down just slightly from where I originally had it. So I'll go with a 3 and a 3. I'll have a 6.
That's 5.5 for the two of us.
Great job. Did you have to use your abacus?
No, I used my fingers. I had one half amputated, so comes in handy.
Oh, did you also put it through a bandsaw like my grandfather?
No, but yeah, that was a table saw, actually.
It's still a saw to me.
Yeah, it's the table saw that I have out in the office garage to use.
I haven't done any woodworking since my senior year of high school, maybe even my junior year now that I think about it, which would have been 15 years ago, 16, 17 years ago. So more than half my life.
That's what she said.
What?
Woodworking. You haven't done any woodworking since high school.
Ah, okay. That makes a whole lot more sense because I did not follow you there for a while.
Yep.
All right, let's go to impact and significance then. In the moment, critics were fairly positive. It got a lot of nominations. It got a few wins in some technical categories. So I have this on a 4 for the industry. I can't go a full 5. I mean, I'm probably being a little generous on the 4, but part of that is also on reflective that on the audience side, you don't even make back your own budget on a fairly well-known play and a fairly best-selling book. I mean, I guess I know that the attitude of America at the time was they didn't want to dwell on a lot of these things, especially by the end of the 50s. But wow, that does not bode well for having a high audience score. So I have a 1 on that side. I have a 5.
Ooh, boy. I have a 4 also, and I'm not going to add too much to what you said. I don't go nearly as low as you on the public. I looked it up. Yeah, it didn't make back its budget, but it was the 15th highest grossing film of 1959.
No. There are no numbers kept enough for you to be able to know what its true ranking was other than the very like top 10 back into the 50s.
They well, just I don't had keep a list of the top 20 grossing films that I found. So I don't go quite that low. I think it had its moment. So I went with a 2 for a 6 overall.
All right. So the top grossing movies.
I know Rio Bravo was on like number 8 or 9, 10, something like that.
13. It didn't make a lot of money in its initial run. No, it was beaten out by Journey to the Center of the Earth, A Hole in the Head, On the Beach, Solomon and Sheba, The Nun's Story. But here's where it starts to get better. North by Northwest in at 7.
Mm-hmm.
Imitation of Life, Pillow Talk at 5. Mm-hmm. Operation Petticoat, mm-hmm. Some Like It Hot, The Shaggy Dog.
That was a Fred McMurray film.
And number 1 at more than double, almost triple, of any other competitor that year, Ben-Hur.
Ah, yes.
So while I think that is a particularly good movie year, Porkchop Hill at 14 still grossed close to what the budget for this film was. And it would have come in at least below that. So I don't think that there was much evidence to say that the audience was behind this film. So what was your official number?
I had 6.
All right. So we inverted from the last category, but ended up at the same average.
Okay.
5.5 if you're still adding on your fingers.
I am.
All right. Novelty.
See, here's my half finger right here.
All right. So for novelty, based on the play, based on the book, almost taken verbatim from the play, and the book is limited in its ability to see a lot of scope comparatively with some of the things that we know because of its point of view. The more novel aspects of this would have been had it gone into the camps, but because she couldn't take the diary with her, and it wouldn't have probably survived had it gone with her, I think that this feels a little lacking in some of the full power and scope that could have been had maybe it gone in that direction. Not that it's the film's fault necessarily, but I don't see anything on an originality scale that's very high for me with this. On the other hand, I think the execution is high. When we were talking about the filmmaking itself, either from particular actor performances or from the direction and how he creates a certain paranoia, creates some fairly understandable human characteristics that we can connect with, this is where I would have this a little bit higher. So for originality on that half of it, I'll go for a 1.5 and I'll take a 3.5 for the execution for a 5 novelty overall.
This was not a subject that was addressed previously. It was a difficult subject, so I'm giving it points for that. This was also a story about confinement and being within the scope of a small environment trying to survive, which I could not think of anything else. In retrospect, when I was thinking about this after I did the initial score this earlier today, I remember another film of the Holocaust, which is Adrian Brody's performance in the Pianist, I believe was the film.
Yes.
Which was the same thing, him having to live in constant fear, being silent, living and praying that somebody brings him food. Otherwise, he's going to be out in the public and be apprehended and such. And so I've seen this in others. Now, the only thing I would say that lacked novelty is that you at least had prison films that showed confinement and the stress of confinement before that. So I did give it a little bit of down for that, but I went with an 8 because I thought it was a unique opportunity as a film that had not been explored or addressed previously.
Kudos for you for bringing up a Roman Polanski film during the recording tonight.
You're welcome. Next week, we'll talk about, for the Passion of the Christ, Rosemary's Baby.
Well, I think we have more than enough to handle with Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really wanted to make a trifecta and then, like, just top it off, not only Polanski, but then bring up Woody Allen and we'll just be covered.
Yeah.
All right. So that's a 6.5 average between the two of us. Classicness. Go ahead.
All right. We started the 7. We have the central story being a young woman coming of age. We have a very sweet and sentimental moment exploring Jewish culture at Hanukkah. We have the characters, even when flawed, stayed within a certain framework of believability. There was nothing that was horrific or subtracting from the story or from how things really were or inappropriate as far as betrayal or in the film itself. I went with a 9 for classicness. I gave it 2 points up because I couldn't find anything that I really thought was troublesome.
If I were to nitpick on anything troublesome, it might be in Mr. Dussel's treatment towards the women in the film, but even that is probably period accurate, so I'm not going to really do anything with that. It just more feeds into that character being kind of an antagonist.
To use the Yiddish word, he was a schmuck.
Sure. I have no disagreement here. What I will say is that going back to a film we discussed in season 1 and that we'll be revisiting later this year, when we discussed All the President's Men, we said, I think you said specifically, that sometimes certain films become more classic because of the period in time in which we re-experience them. And given that we are post-COVID, so I think that the setting, the trials and tribulations of confinement are a little bit more in recent memory for a lot of people, even if we've tried to basically black out those 2 years, 2.5 years, whatever it was. And a lot of that runs together. I think there is still some scar tissue there to draw upon that makes this a little bit more relevant. And then the notion of where we're at, both politically and the, I would say, nationalist or fascist notions in which I believe we find ourselves not only as a country, but just globally. I think this takes on a different meaning. So I had it up a couple of points for timelessness and relevancy. I will match your 9.
Okay. That's a 9 overall.
Now, did you use the other 9 fingers that aren't stubby?
I actually took off my shoes.
Okay. Rewatchability. I hate to do this, but there were a lot of sections of this movie that were pretty boring for me. And it's been 20, 25 years since I've seen it originally. And that's probably good enough. Like, maybe if I put it on for some unknown reason, but I think there are movies that hit a lot better, probably are a little bit more expansive. Like if I'm going to show somebody a Holocaust movie, I'm going Schindler's List before I'm going this. Just
yeah,
the sheer shock and horror. This is more something you would maybe dip the toe in the water for school children or middle school age, where that can't handle the level at which Schindler's List is operating at. Obviously, that's just a much different film with a much different class of horror in it.
Yes.
So it does have its place, but my likelihood to put it on of my own volition is probably a one. I can see very few circumstances where I'm just going to put it on. It's not necessarily like something fun. And while it's an okay movie, it just drags in certain spots. So between that and if it's on, like, are you going to sit through the full 3 hours if you catch it like 20 minutes in? I just can't see myself doing that either. If I'm going to put it on, I likely will finish it, but it's not something that like you're flipping through cable and, oh, Anchorman is on or Dodgeball or any of the like other fun favorites that you're stopping everything you're doing to watch the end of that film. Shawshank for certain people or Pulp Fiction or whatever, you know,
yeah,
your favorites that are on cable that week. This is not one of them. So I have a one to put it on. I have a two that I would finish it. I have a three.
I went with a little bit more, which is if it's on, I'll watch it at least partly. This is one where it's best done in increments. You find it on, you pause it, then you go back and watch, oh, I don't know, 4, 5, 10 minutes of the basketball game. Then you come back and watch another 10, 15 minutes of the film. And I'm saying that not because I'm trying to detract from the film. It's just that it's such a difficult subject and heavy subject to watch. It's just, and at times it's really painful to sit and just watch people sit in a building or in a room and do nothing. You know, it is what it is. So I went with a 5 for rewatchability. Again, I believe that's a 4 between us.
Very good.
See, I don't need help with the math.
For our audience score, we had an 88% for Google users and a 77% for Rotten Tomato users, giving us an 8.25 score. So to recap the categories, we had a 5.5 for legacy, a 5.5 for impact and significance, a 6.5 for novelty, a 9 for classicness, a 4 for rewatchability, and an 8.25 for audience score, giving us a final total of 38.75, and currently placing it on our list between Stalag 17 and The Waterboy.
Wow. Our list is growing more eclectic every day.
Yeah, to say the least. So if you disagree with any of our scoring or just simply have comments for us, you can write us at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us on YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle @GModePodcast. We will take any of your feedback, and maybe if your comments are good enough, we will read them on the show. Let's go to remaining questions then. I have none.
Nor do I.
Okay.
I know how World War II ends.
Well, you obviously know the ending of this story and kind of the subsequent material offshoots of that. So yes. There isn't a whole lot. I guess the one ambiguous question is how were they caught or how were they found out, which apparently has never been a resolved question. There are a lot of discussions as to whether it was a worker that kind of ratted them out, that was a newer guy, whether it was one of the burglars as set up by the movie or, you know, something else, but it's never truly been resolved and it's been a hot button topic. So I guess that would be the one lone thing, but that's it.
What I was told or what I'd heard, the most recent one was, and I think this was from the Anne Frank Museum, was that it was one of the workers who got accused of being involved in some sort of black market activity, and he bought his freedom from the Gestapo by ratting out the Franks.
Still not sure how to respond to that, but.
Yeah, well, very difficult time, and I hope it never repeats.
So let's move into something much, much lighter. Ask Dana Anything.
We're referring to this now as the ADA?
Yes, because AMAs are Ask Me Anything. This is Ask Dana Anything, so ADA.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, I'm ready.
So I have four questions, two of which we'll take this week, two of which we'll do next week, so as not to exhaust them too quickly. I have one that I would describe as somewhat existential. I have one that's just outright silliness. I have one that is truly a movie question, but it's genre specific. And then I have kind of a tried and true movie question.
Okay, let's do one of the two movie questions, and then you can pick whichever of the other two you would like.
No, this is for you. Which of those? I'm not going to pick for you.
Okay, give me the absolutely silly one.
All right. Would you rather fight a horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
I think I would rather fight one horse-sized duck because you don't only have to beat it one time. And I think that a horse-sized duck would not move about very well or freely. And I think it would be easier to fight it than the potential of 100 little duck-sized horses stomping on you with hooves.
See, I take the opposite approach. You are fighting a horse-sized duck, which means it has the proportions of a horse. And while it doesn't necessarily move as well as a horse, it's still going to have a little bit more power behind it. Whereas even if it's 100 duck-sized horses, they aren't coming up very high. Their muscles aren't nearly as developed. Their kick isn't going to be nearly as sting. Because even me, who is a fairly short man, a duck doesn't really come up to my knee unless they like fully extend. So what's a horse going to do? I could basically just like kick a lot. And if you give me, you know, any type of equipment to fight it with, I would rather do the 100 duck-sized horses.
Well, you asked my question. This is,
I know,
Ask Dana, and I gave you my answer and my reasoning. I mean, whatever.
All right. So which other one did you want to take?
I'll do the genre-specific movie.
Okay. So this does incorporate our most frequent guest. If you could wave a magic wand and make Mom unafraid of horror movies for one day, what would you show her?
The Exorcist.
That's a good one. I haven't seen it yet. I think it is eventually coming up on the show. I know we will cover it at some point. I don't know when, but that is said to be the most horrifying horror film possibly ever made.
Yeah. And the one that I would have said originally was Silence of the Lambs. She refused to even have me put it on anywhere in the house for a long time. Then during lockdown, she had to isolate out in her parents' RV in the parking lot of the office. And she watched it, by herself in a mobile home in the middle of a parking lot in the middle of the night. And I'm like,
it's really not as scary as I thought it would be. Like, it was built up in my mind by her refusing to watch it and you making a big deal out of the movie. But it's really not that bad. It's much more to me of a thriller than it is necessarily a horror film. But we'll incorporate it into the horror genre itself. We have a really great definition discussion during our Jaws revisit from season 2, if you want to listen to that. For me, because I know she hates Jack Nicholson, I'd have her watch The Shining.
Yeah, yeah. As far as that goes, is what I was talking about. As far as why I think Silence of the Lambs was so scary, I read the book first. And quite frankly, the book was much scarier than the movie.
And that's probably true, but this was supposed to go towards a mass audience.
Yeah.
So, all right. Those are our two questions for the week. Otherwise, any remaining thoughts for the week?
No.
All right. I don't really either. We've just had so much content out in the last 2 weeks that I got nothing rattling around in the old noodle. So on to Passion of the Christ.
Yes.
All right. Well, that'll do it for us this week. Thank you for listening. Forgive them, Father. They know not what they do. Next week, for our 205th episode, we discuss the unforeseen smash hit from 2004, The Passion of the Christ, celebrating its 20th anniversary. Written and directed by Mel Gibson with Benedict Fitzgerald, music by John Debney, starring Jim Caviezel and Monica Bellucci. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where it's streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. Please like, follow, rate, and review, or whatever on whichever platform you have, so that more can join in our fun. You can also email the show at thenewRodneyDuncanStudios.com or at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us on YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle at Gmode Podcast. The Greatest Movie of All Time is a production of Ronnie Duncan Studios. Our show is mixed, edited, and written by Thomas Duncan. Our music is thanks to Purple Planet Music. Our technical provider and distributor is Captivate FM.